You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good morning, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia, and I just wanted to say, broadcasting live from sunny South Florida, except it's not sunny. Although, compared to where most people are, it's pretty darn nice because it's 71 degrees here on my patio, and that's what I'm using for my broadcast center today. I'm fortunate I'm able to do that. Listen, if you missed any of the last couple of shows, we had some great guests. Last week, we had Lori Cardoza Moore, President of Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, award-winning filmmaker, and just a great guest. We had a great show. Then the show before that went way longer, the interview did, than we ever anticipated because we were having so much fun. David Mercaldo, author, educator, playwright, speaker, and America's storyteller. That's what he's known as. Great guy. And he had a little part to play in the interview that we're going to be doing today because we're going to be talking about the book Officer's Oath as well as some other things. And he had some input on that book. He's a great writer. And we talked a little bit about the subject we're going to talk about today. But today we have with us Marco Ciavellino, who worked on Terry's case since the initial action was taken. If you don't know who Terry Lakin is, he's the doctor who said, no, I'm not going to deploy because we have a president who is not legal to be a president and commander-in-chief, so I'm not, you know, this is a order that I don't have to follow, and anyway, took a stand, and that's my interpretation of it. We're going to get Marco to tell us exactly what transpired, and we go through the whole, step through the whole thing. But since Terry's incarceration, Marco has acted as the administrative trustee for the Terry Lakin Action Fund. He oversees Terry's websites and external communication, and is the publisher and editor of Terry's book, Officer's Oath, and is a co-executive producer of the forthcoming film about Terry's story. So we couldn't be happier to have you here today, Marco. How are you doing today, sir?
Very well, and it's not sunny here in Maryland, but I asked you to send me some sun, so see if you can do that.
I'm going to give my best shot. So listen, we want to talk about... Just give us a little intro and background on yourself and what was going on, and then we'll go right on into a quick little restatement of Terry's story, and then you can update us on that. But just go ahead and take it away for a little bit here.
Well, Tom, basically about 3.5 years ago, I was just sitting at my desk, and I got a call from another technology vendor here in Baltimore with whom I work frequently, and he says, hey, do you want to run tech for a lawsuit? And I'm like, sure, I'll do that. What is it? Oh, well, we're trying to contest Barack Obama's eligibility and remove him from office. And I, excellent, sign me up. And so for the first year and a half, I worked with Paul Jensen and Ducky Hemingway and the initial team that Terry had gathered around when he finally decided to make this big statement. And so that I kind of worked in the background. And then when Terry switched attorneys, the new attorney had only one focus, was to keep Terry out of prison for 5 years. And so Terry's brother and Terry came to me and said, would you do this? I'd become very good friends with Terry during that time and have subsequently. And so right after, you know, right during the trial, I was doing background support. And then as soon as the trial was over, I took this over. We created the TerryLakin.com site, TerryLakinActionFund.com. And subsequently have done a radio show for him, and I helped produce the book. That's how I met David Mercaldo, as we'll talk about in a minute. And we've continued to maintain Terry's forward-facing identification for his story. And he has, again, just become a very good friend. And it's been quite an adventure. Let me tell you, Tom, quite an adventure.
Yeah, well, I guess so. Now, let me ask you something. That when you were going through this initially, and the trial was underway and trying to keep Terry out of prison, et cetera, was there a significant move to actually prove that the president's documentation is falsified, thereby boosting Terry's claim, or was it just on another basis? What was the basis for trying to keep him out of jail?
Well, let's back up just one step, and then we'll answer that question. You know, even as we announced the movie yesterday, I yet got more kind of vulgar emails from people. The issue was that Terry had tried for 2 years, very patiently and completely within procedure. In fact, almost no one even knew he was doing it, to just simply get confirmation of the legality of the commander-in-chief. And when that was not forthcoming, and he had repeatedly been told, well, you're responsible to the chain of command, you know, it doesn't really matter. But when Obama stood up and ordered directly a surge to Afghanistan, that's when Terry said, look, this is as clear as it gets. It's a direct order from the person who is standing in the commander-in-chief position, and I want to know if his orders are legal. And that's when Terry chose to disobey a direct order, and the actual crime was missing movement, and that's what he was court-martialed for.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they had hoped, Tom, that in the trial that the normal process of evidentiary finding would allow them to depose people and take interviews and get evidence. But as anyone who's followed the case knows, he was basically allowed to demonstrate zero evidence. So he literally went to court with nothing but an empty folder. That's what ended up happened.
Yeah. Well,
and subsequently, of course, people have continued to pursue it. So. No.
Yeah, it would be obvious to me that he, you know, doesn't, there's no documentation, or you can't get your hands on documentation because it's either doesn't exist or it's falsified. You know, I don't know how many people out there have their birth certificate. I've got a birth certificate, the original birth certificate when I was born. I'm 52 years old, and I have my original birth certificate. I've also sent off to the Office of Registration, whatever it's called, it's on the tip of my tongue. But in any case, the census kind of folks. Anyway, because when I was doing various things throughout my life, various job applications, et cetera, I had to provide an original birth certificate. Not the original, but an original. And I can call that office at any time I want and say, hey, I need two more original, you know, signed, certified birth certificates. And, you know, they'll say, yeah, send us $20 and we'll send them to you. It's not hard at all. So I don't understand how the state of Hawaii can't issue a whole stack of official birth certificates, but they won't do it. And you're right, the evidence, the documentation isn't there, what you've seen on the internet. People say, well, Tom, you're a birther. You know what? No, I'm just a truther is what I am. I like the truth. And the truth is, this is extremely suspect, and I honestly don't believe that the right documentation is there. Now, does that mean he just couldn't find it? Well, that's why you can always go back to the original state or city that you're in and get another birth certificate issued, and yet Hawaii won't do that. So that's very strange.
Right. Well, it's actually a little even more confusing than that. In some ways, the birth certificate is almost irrelevant. The fact is, I mean, it's part of it. The fact is, Tom, if I took $500 and spent an hour on the web and hired a private investigator to go to your hometown where you were born, which I could easily find, we could learn more about you in 36 hours by just hanging around talking to people than we know. And I've challenged people on this who have contested me. Tell me what you actually know about Barack Obama, except that he's married to Michelle and has two children. I mean, that's about it. There's no other information, and it's the vacuum is appalling. I mean, I had this discussion with my dad the other day at lunch. I said, Dad, look, if I took $100 out of my wallet and walked around this little Arby's restaurant we were in, I'll bet you every person could go produce a birth certificate within less than an hour if I had $500 to hand them, right? It's just ludicrous. And so, and even more ludicrous, of course, was when Terry was in prison, they somehow mysteriously came up with the long-form birth certificate, which, of course, has subsequently been, you know, annihilated by experts. And the fact that the public has allowed him to continue this facade is amazing. I call it the vanilla ice cream problem. Tom, if I said to you, what's your favorite kind of ice cream? You said, not chocolate. Oh, come on, what is it? Not vanilla, not cherry. We could do this for years, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
right.
The bottom line is, we're not talking about some local backyard club. This is the office of the President of the United States, and we should expect and demand more information to be forthcoming than we have. And it's amazing, amazing that this has not been handled.
Yeah, well, you know what I think? I think some people are afraid once he's out of office, I'm going to bet there's going to be all kinds of information and people step forward once they know that they can't be harmed by this guy anymore, because we know that he's a dangerous guy, quite honestly. You know, he's a former Chicago politics thug type guy who uses those type of intimidation techniques, and you know, people disappear, and people, you know, I'm not going to say that this president would do that specifically, but he could certainly harm your life. I mean, we're reading about how the EPA is destroying businesses all across the country by not actually following procedure and honestly doing things deceptively because they're on a mission to shut down oil and gas production. So they're going after some of these smaller companies. And this is all the president's direction. So, yeah, he can harm you. But once he's out of office, I think we're going to see all kinds of information come out that's going to show us exactly what kind of a liar and possibly not even citizen of the United States of America he is. Or that he
right.
was a citizen, but he lied to get into college about not being a citizen. So there's something there's obviously something he's covering up here.
Right, and the issue, of course, isn't even this drives me crazy to hear educated. So he could be a citizen. I mean, my dog could be a citizen. The fact is, it's the issue of natural born citizenship. But let's go back. So basically, Terry took a stand on this. He was court martialed. It was an egregious, you know, farcical kind of hearing, though it was procedurally correct. In the end, he simply was guilty of the crime that he committed. He could have gotten 5 years hard labor. But they were able to negotiate it such a way that he got 6 months. And I started to get people email, oh, he's not really in prison. He's like in some country. Well, you know, I'll just tell you, Tom, I was there, and it was a real prison in every single way. So,
right.
So Terry spent 6 months in prison, had a huge life change. First of all, he had two phenomenal cellmates, both of whom were Christians and really ministered to him. His second cellmate and he basically started a revival in the chapel at the prison. They went from like four people showing up to like 60. He ended up working in the chapel library and just read and read and read and read and read and read and just totally bolstered his faith. And when he got out of prison, of course, Jack Cashel, who many people know, offered to help write Terry's book and did a phenomenal job. I just encourage everybody to read the book. It's a remarkable story. And then David Mercaldo, who you interviewed, who absolutely has become a great friend of mine, and authored the entire second half of the book, where we had him interview 30 or 40 people involved in this movement to show the breadth and depth and interest here, that it wasn't just a bunch of crazy people. It's a bunch of really well-educated people from every walk of life and every socioeconomic background and every ethnic background who care about the Constitution. And that's what the whole focus of the book is driving at. So that's that. And then, of course, yesterday, Tom, we announced that we are going to pursue a cinematic version of the book. So very exciting stuff.
Cool. Yeah, very exciting. Well, what's Terry up to these days? What's going on in his life now?
Well, his medical license in Maryland and Colorado remained. He was rejected in Kansas in what was just a bizarre kind of hearing, where the lead attorney essentially re-court-martialed him, was completely out of place, and it's being appealed. So he wanted to leave Maryland. He wanted to be closer to his family. So he's now working at a private practice in Colorado and working very hard and enjoying himself and resettling. You got to remember, he had everything taken from him. All they really had in the end was some savings in their house. Their house, in Maryland, the market is terrible, so they took a huge hit on the house. But they're resettled and resettling into a new community, and he loves practicing medicine, absolutely loves it.
Yeah. Well, the best doctors do, and that's awesome. So he's able to keep pretty busy. I understand he's actually quite busy. Some puts in long, long days working at the hospital or the clinic there.
Yeah, actually, it's been a real insight for me having him talk about some of what is going on in medicine, and it's pretty scary. I mean, the reason he's working such long hours, Tom, is the reporting requirements are off the scale. He'll go in at 5 in the morning, do 2.5 hours of charts, see 40 patients, and then have to do another 2 hours of charting, and it's just crazy. I have no idea we're going to end up with Obamacare, but it's a huge concern. And that's, you know, he spends way too much time not practicing medicine, as many doctors do. So,
yeah.
You know, it's really, really interesting. So that's kind of where it's at. And we've continued, as you know, and we'd love to have him on the air, and we may get him on the air with you another time. It's hard during the day for him to do that.
Yeah.
But he is getting more, he's just slowly, it's really interesting, Tom. It's taken a couple of years for him to really get comfortable talking about this with the passion he feels about the issue. I mean, the guy gave up everything And to date, the only person who acted on the oath that every federal officer and elected official takes. Unbelievable that they are sitting down there in Washington, all these smart people cannot get this together and take action on it. I can't figure it out.
Yeah, well, it's just, I think they're a little bit afraid. They don't want to come across as a wacko because the media, see, this is the biggest problem we have today, is that the media is on the side of the criminal, godless left. That's the side they're on because that's quite honestly what they are. They're criminal and godless. And they are going to portray to the masses, and here's the really big problem with them being on the side of the criminal left. They're going to portray any story that comes out any way they want, right or wrong, to support the left and their criminal intentions. And I know I keep saying the word criminal. I just like saying that just because I have the power to say that with this microphone. You know, it's freedom of speech. But honestly, they have the ability to shape the masses, and they've done that. Look, Obama got reelected. They shaped the masses. A guy who has done a terrible job in his first 4 years, and he gives a State of the Union address, and what's the State of the Union? It's worse than it was before he got elected, and yet the media portrays it as, oh, we're on a roll, just, you know, keep on looking ahead and things are getting better. We can see on down the road they're better. And they've been saying that for 4 years. They've been lying to the American people. And that's the biggest problem, I think, is people are afraid, unlike Terry, unlike Dr. Lakin, to take a stand and say, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. We don't care what the media is going to say. But there still is that problem. The media will bury stories and then highlight stories that harm the effort to bring about the truth and hold this president accountable. And so that's why I think it's just going to, we're just going to have to wait until he's no longer president. And then I think the media, in their insatiable desire for a story, once he's no longer president, they'll get all over it. If evidence starts coming out, the kind of evidence we know is there, that's been buried and attempted to be hidden, then they'll jump on it because, hey, you know, he's not president anymore. He's not our cause, you know. He's not taking the torch forward for the liberal, progressive, godless left. And that's what I think is going to happen. Yeah, but unfortunately, we've got to wait another
right.
4 years.
Yeah, well, and here's the scary part of that. There's a couple of different like legal theories on this. And people have probably the most frequent question I get is, why won't anyone act on this? And there's a couple of different general thoughts on this, and some of them are very real, but they're not reasons to disregard the Constitution. One is that any attempt to in any way remove Obama or challenge him will result in broad civil unrest beyond anything we've seen before. I think that's possible. I think that's a real concern, but it's not a reason, again, to disregard the Constitution. The second is that there's something that has occurred that has caused people great fear to act, which is hard to believe on such a broad level, but there does seem to be some kind of recurring evidence of that. And thirdly, of course, is that I think, again, a very practical reason, but not a reason to disregard the Constitution, is that if by some amazing thing in the next, you know, whenever it happens, someone finally stands up and says, whoa, you know, this was a big mistake. We have, talk about complexity, we would have decades of legal entanglement to untangle. I mean, their questions would come up about legality of everything he did. Every person, every soldier who died under his command would be able to challenge it. I mean, it would be a morass of morasses. And yet, again, it's not a reason to disregard the Constitution of the United States.
No, absolutely not. Well, you know, you made a point earlier, and I just want to highlight this for listeners out there in case you don't understand this concept. And when you said the birth certificate really is meaningless, it's about being a natural-born citizen, that's precisely it. All of the stuff that went on, even Donald Trump saying, well, just come on, show me your, you know, I want to see a real copy of birth certificate, that had nothing to do with it. He could very well have a legitimate birth certificate, but in fact, you must be a natural-born citizen to be eligible to be president of the United States. And what does that mean? That means that both parents are citizens. They don't have to be natural citizens. They could have come here from another country, gained citizenship, but they both had U.S. citizenship. And we know for a fact from Obama's own writings in his own book, his father was not a citizen of the United States, never was, ever. So he had a mother that was a citizen and a father who was not. That does not meet the definition of natural-born citizen. So he, therefore, was and is ineligible to be president of the United States. It has nothing to do with whether he has a U.S. birth certificate. And too many people and the media never talked about that. It's got nothing to do with being a U.S. citizen. It's a natural-born U.S. citizen. And you made that point earlier, but I just wanted to highlight that because that's a very important point.
And there are some different views on the NBC clause, the natural-born citizen clause, yet he doesn't meet any of them, Tom. So
no, he doesn't meet any of them. Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Now, we're coming up on the end of my time. By the way, today is Valentine's Day, and I am going to lunch with my wife. I would encourage everybody to do something similar if you for your significant other. But let's close this out. So a couple of things. First of all, this is very, very critical. A couple weeks ago, I interviewed Paul Guthrie on my show, who's doing a phenomenal job in Illinois with legal actions. And one thing he pointed out that I had never considered before, though I probably should have connected it up, is that if we allow this to continue, we dilute or almost eliminate the concept of natural law citizenship. If citizenship can be capriciously assigned, natural-born citizenship, it can be capriciously removed. Our Constitution guarantees us a role because of who we are, not who tells us who we are. And that's why it's so important that we get this straight. Secondly is, obviously, I want to encourage everybody to go over to terrylakin.com and officersoath.com, buy a copy of Terry's book, read it, pass it on, and then go over to commandertaffy.com, which is our production site, and read about the movie and consider getting involved. We're looking to raise $25,000 on what will eventually be a $1 million budget, and Dean and I need some money to move around and start to line up the people we need, and I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a great film.
Well, it sounds awesome. I mean, the book itself is fantastic. The story is fantastic. And Terry, Dr. Terry sure is a true patriot. Marco, you're a patriot as well for getting involved in this and sticking with him and by his side and turning this into what it is to enlighten the people out there. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Keep up the good work. We'll follow how things are going and, of course, continue to promote the book as well as the upcoming movie. Marco Ciavolino, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Have a great day, and hopefully we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Sounds good. All right, Marco, take care.
Take care.
Well, that's an awesome story, isn't it, folks? I mean, and let me give you a couple of the websites again here. You can go to terrylakin.com, that's L-A-K-I-N. There's also the terrylakinactionfund.com. Check that site out. Then you've got officersoath.com, and then, as Marco mentioned there at the very end, Commander Taffy, that's T-A-F-F-Y, commandertaffy.com. And you can find out about what's going on with the movie. I'm sure it's going to be a great movie. And the great thing about movies is this. A lot of people just won't pick up a book, you know, but they'll go and watch a movie. They'll rent a DVD. And that really has been a great way in the last couple of years of getting a lot of great information out to as many people as possible. So hopefully this is something that'll take off and have drive the interest of the masses. It very well could. Very well could, and let's keep our fingers crossed on that. So it is Valentine's Day. I'd like to say happy Valentine's to everybody out there who is got a relationship, even if it's just with your children or your parents. You know, they can be your Valentine and your special someone for today. And give them a call, send them a card. And if you have a wife or girlfriend, take her out to dinner, guys. Absolutely. And you better get her a card and a little something to go with that. So Nancy and I actually celebrated Valentine's Day last night. We went to a very nice seafood place that specializes in Maine lobster, and we had ourselves a 3.5-pound Maine lobster that we split. Oh, it was massive. Just awesome. Huge claws, big tail. Split the tail in half, and the chef split it right down the middle. So as I pulled the tail out and gave half of it to Nancy, each half was the size of a normal lobster tail. So we had a very, very nice dinner, a nice romantic evening, and it was quite nice. We really enjoyed it. So we beat the masses, and quite honestly, there were a lot of people out there. I think a lot of people decided to celebrate it a night early just to kind of beat the rush and make sure they can get in and get in on a good reservation and that kind of thing. So anyway, Valentine's Day, don't forget your significant other or anybody else in your life that's important to you. Now, I highly recommend people go on over to the American Thinker website because there are some great articles on there. I'm just going to run down through a few of the articles. One article near and dear to me is about the airline oligopoly Advances of American and U.S. Airways announce a merger. Now, you know, this is always about the passenger. And I just see from the little headline there, fasten your seatbelt, the ride for airline passengers is going to get, if not bumpier, more expensive. Let me just say this about airline travel. Back when it was regulated by the government and you had, you know, just specific carriers, you couldn't start up an airline if you wanted to. Well, you could get the approval of the government, but that wasn't easy. Prices based on adjusted for inflation were much, much higher than they are today. Much, much higher. So we're always focused on the passenger, but now let's take another focus. How about the people that buy stock in an airline, that invest in an airline? All of the people employed, not just the direct employees, but all of the peripheral employees that supply airplane parts, paper. You should see the amount of paper I have to print out every time I go flying for not just the flight plan, but all kinds of notes and information, and a lot of it's, I see the same stuff every time. But I've got to have it with me, and so it's just reams and stacks of paper. So just the paper alone, a paper company that's supplying us, we've got to be buying millions and millions of dollars worth of paper product just to carry in the cockpit on every single flight. So there are a lot of people employed. There are a lot of people that are retired from these companies and have pensions. A lot of people are covered by health care. I have a good health care plan, although it's gotten more expensive thanks to Obamacare, but I have a good health care plan. And so I'm not dependent on the taxpayer for my health care. I'm dependent on myself and the company that puts money into this plan. And because the company that I belong to is so big, we get fairly good rates. Not so much anymore, like I said, but for many years we've gotten very, very good rates. Okay. So with that all said, from the perspective of all of those people that are employed, et cetera, the airline tickets today are at all-time historical lows compared to back in the days of the 50s and 60s with regulation and pre-deregulation. So regulation by the government of who could fly airplanes and where. You also have so much more travel available to you. You can fly so many more places and get to little towns, big towns, and the frequency is so much higher under deregulation. Now, when we say deregulation, is it deregulation? Well, it's somewhat deregulated. That's the catch always when the government has control of something, says, well, we're going to deregulate it. They actually continue to regulate it. They just don't regulate it as much. So this idea that passengers are going to now start paying more, well, what is an airline ticket worth? Is it worth airlines continually going into bankruptcy and having to pay 50 cents on the dollar to all their creditors and investors and employees because they can never make any money and they can't make money because tickets are so cheap? Because the government's always focused on the passenger. Now, let me give you a perfect example of this, and I haven't even gotten to airline management yet, but we're going to get to that. Okay. In the 90s, there were all kinds of startup carriers. Since I have been a pilot, an airline pilot, for about 21 years now, there have been well over 200 startup carriers. And of those 200 little startup carriers that, oh, boy, you could get a $19 ticket on, when they first started up because they weren't paying any bills, initially. And airplane manufacturing companies were so glad to get airplanes, produce airplanes and sell them that they'd give them to them for the first year for free or for 6 months for free or really low leasing rights to begin with, et cetera. They just want to get those things out on the market. They could offer $19 tickets. How many of those carriers are left? Out of the probably close to 230 startup carriers in the last 21 years, there are only about three. That are left. Three. So what does this all mean, Tom? Well, I'll tell you. It means that during the 90s, when legacy carriers like United, Delta, American, Continental, Northwest were being sued by the federal government for predatory pricing of the little carriers, because it's always the big evil carriers, it's always the big evil companies, it's always big evil something or other, big evil banks and on and on. These legacy carriers were getting sued and pressured not to compete with the little guys so that we could have prices nice and cheap and low for the consumer because it's all about the consumer. Well, all those little carriers are gone, and all of the legacy carriers, because they were unable to make money in the 90s the way they could have, they could have been making money hand over fist, all had to go through bankruptcy. After 9/11, most of them took some assistance from the federal government. Yes, you're taxpaying dollars to keep them afloat right after 9/11. So where does this all go? You know, it all goes back to capitalism. If the government would stay out of the business of business and let the free market decide what the value of a service or good is, then we all end up winners in the end. We don't have bankrupt companies. We don't have companies that have to that are too big to fail and have to be bailed out on and on and on. The market does its normal process of scrubbing and getting rid of companies that have failed management teams, as many of these companies did. They had weak managers, corrupt management teams that were just soaking the company for, you know, money. In other words, the company's losing money, and they're paying themselves massive bonuses and big salaries. Yeah, that stuff goes on. So that's got to be kept in check. I have actually high hopes, not just because I'm going to be part of this, but I believe this merger with American and U.S. Airways is actually going to be quite good for both companies. Because of the consolidation with United and the companies that they absorbed and Delta, American and U.S. Airways really weren't going to be able to compete in the future, especially U.S. Airways, too small. American was going to have a difficulty and needed the expansion of U.S. Airways. And this is not a merger. People will say, well, Americans bought companies in the past, and then those companies like DWA and AirCal and Reno Air, and where are they today? I mean, where are those routes today? They're gone. That's not the same with U.S. Airways. U.S. Airways has some extensive routes that are quite valuable and hubs that are valuable, and this is an actual merger. American did not buy, and U.S. Airways did not buy. They're actually simply merging together. So don't get too upset about ticket prices and where things are going to go. There's just going to be actually be American / U.S. Airways, which will now be called American. U.S. Airways, the name will be essentially gone, because American has much broader name recognition throughout the world, and that's a smart move. The new American Airlines is going to be able to compete better with Delta and United, and you're going to see some nice, good competition, healthy competition among the airlines. So I wouldn't worry about the prices, but this is, you know, Thomas Lipson wrote this, and he writes some great articles, but he doesn't know much about the airline industry, so he's, you know, it's an interesting article. But some of the other articles, now I want to point one out, and then we're going to wrap things up because it is Valentine's Day, and we've got a lot of stuff to do today, like go buy some flowers and other things like that while we have the chance. Here we've got an article by Rick Moran. He writes some great articles. In Obama's America, chanting USA is racist. So I'll just give you a little view here, and then you can go find the article if you want. But some great articles on American Think. I highly recommend going and checking out the articles each day. A whole new set of articles and blogs each day, each and every day. Sometimes throughout the day they get updated. They're not updating the story, but they throw another one or two in there. Okay, so we all have to be good little world citizens and not show that we care much about the United States. It just isn't cool in the first place. Secondly, do we detect a racist element in proclaiming love of country? Ask the Oxnard Union School District Superintendent. This is from National Review. Four California high school students were reportedly suspended for chanting USA and wearing American flag bandanas during a basketball game. While their punishment has since been rescinded, school administrators said the incident is far from over. The superintendent, Gabe Sumekian, that's how you pronounce his name, who cares, told Fox News Radio that we need to pursue this further. Why, dummy? Okay, because we've got to work with teachers and students and community about the concept of cultural proficiency. Oh, great, here we go. Another politically correct term that really means shut up. No more freedom of speech. Okay. So the Camarillo High School principal, Glenn Lippman, felt that the students' actions might have had racist undertones since the schools have large Hispanic student populations. Okay, let me see here. First of all, the schools can't have large Hispanic student populations because the school is located in California, so they would have to be large American student populations. But we could say Americans of Hispanic heritage, but they are Americans, right? And they do love the United States of America, because if they don't love the United States of America, what do they love? Maybe they ought to go back to that. They go to that country. We wanted to make sure their actions weren't racially motivated. And I told the kids I just wanted to be sensitive to the feelings of everybody. Well, I'm an American of Hispanic heritage, and chanting USA, USA, and wearing a flag bandana. I wear a flag like, you know, it's not the flag. That wouldn't be right, but it's got the some of the design of our American flag. Colors altered a little bit, you know, some yellowishness in it to make it look a little rustic. That's a tie I wear with my airline uniform. Am I somehow being insensitive to Americans of Hispanic heritage that might be flying on my airplane? I'm the guy flying the airplane on American of Hispanic heritage. This political correctness just goes way too far. So there you go. There's a story. You know, so what if the Americans of Hispanic heritage started chanting Mexico, Mexico, Mexico? I mean, this is their thing here. Would that be okay? Probably, actually, the leadership there would probably be okay with that. But the reality is, we're not in Mexico. We're in the United States of America. And if you don't like when somebody chants USA and is proud of their country, then you need to get the hell out of here. Because I travel all over the world, especially down in Latin America, Mexico, and South America. And those people don't hold back. There, you would never find a kid being suspended for chanting Nicaragua, Nicaragua, Nicaragua. Or, you know, Costa Rica, or Honduras, at a basketball game and wearing the colors of the flag. That would never happen anywhere else. So how did we get so stupid in this country? It's the criminal, godless left, because they want to eliminate all sense of pride in this country, because we don't really deserve it in their minds. No, we're evil. We're bad. We're bad for the world. We're bad for the country. We've got to turn into mindless little drones like the ants you see crawling along the ground and just do your job and do what we tell you. Go where we tell you. That's what they want. So that's my ode to the criminal, godless left today. I want to thank you for tuning in. And, of course, we had some great shows last week. This next week's a little bit up in the air because I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling. But pay attention to the website as well as Facebook. Go to the American Hour show on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at The American Hour. And, of course, the website, just go to TomGarcia.com. It'll take you right to the page on the USA Radio Network that is my page. And check out what's coming up. And if we're going to have a pop-up show. The great thing about this is you can always download a show after the fact. You don't have to listen to it live. But if you listen to it live, you can call in. Thanks for joining us today. See you next week. And have a safe and wonderful weekend. A nice Valentine's Day.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.